My name's Dave Andrews, and I'm from Australia. And in Australia, we normally greet people by saying g'day. So, g'day. The other day, in fact, it was only 24 hours ago, but it seems a long time ago, I said that I'd been increasingly depressed. And one of the reasons is that I've often felt completely powerless to change the world and make the world the kind of place that I would like to see it to be. In my country, in Australia, over 1 million Australians in recent years have marched across bridges as a sign of commitment to reconciliation with Aboriginal people. And we've called on the government to issue a formal apology to the traditional people of Australia. But our government refuses to say sorry. In recent years, many of you will have been aware of the fact that refugees have been coming to Australia by boat, seeking asylum, fleeing from places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And our government has practiced a really get-tough policy on asylum seekers, actually excising parts of the Australian coastline so that if asylum seekers happen to step foot on our country, they cannot claim due process under Australian law. Hundreds of groups and thousands of people in my country have begged our government to change the policy to do justice to asylum seekers, but they steadfastly refuse to do so. Before the war against Iraq, the Senate in my country passed a vote of no confidence against the government. The first time in 200 years. And a majority of the population supported the Senate. But our government still steadfastly refused to listen to the people. And they decided to join the coalition of the willing, what we call the coalition of the killing. A number of people in my community have become increasingly distressed about these policies, increasingly concerned about the injustice that is being committed in our name. My friend Jim Dowling recently decided it was time to act, that he needed to do something. And so what he did was he decided that after contacting his local politician many times, appealing for him to review the government policy on the war in Iraq, and being met with constant disregard, that he would actually arrest his local member of parliament, that he would actually a classic citizen's arrest. So he waited until the local member was speaking at a large local gathering. And Jim, who's quite a scruffy guy, actually shaved and wore a suit. He still, I think, had bare feet. But he turned up out of this meeting as a responsible citizen, and lay his hand on Peter Dutton, the Member of Parliament, and said, "I arrest you in the name of the people for crimes against humanity." Peter Dutton said he was going to call the police, and Jim said that he was welcome to, that he wanted to hand him over to the police. The police were called. They arrived in large numbers, in big blue and white cars with flashing lights. But instead of arresting Peter Dutton, they arrested my friend Jim for arresting Peter Dutton. So Jim was taken away. A few weeks later, I went to the court case. And at the court case, Jim was on trial as a public nuisance. And the judge said to Jim, "Mr. Dowling, why did you try to arrest Peter Dutton?" And Jim said, "Well, according to the UN, this war against Iraq is illegal. And we know that even though people don't want to keep numbers, that at least 100,000 innocent civilians have been killed. Now, it seems to me that if the war is illegal and 100,000 people have been killed, this is a war crime. And I've arrested Mr. Dutton in the name of the people because of his complicity as a member of the government." And then the judge said something very interesting. He said, "Mr. Dowling, you may be right. Let's concede that our government is guilty of war crimes. The question I have to ask you is, under what law would you think Mr. Dutton would be prosecuted?" And Jim said, "The Nuremberg laws that were set up to judge people who committed crimes in the names of government." And the judge turned to Jim and said, "Very well. Well, I have one question to ask you." And Jim said, "What is that?" And he said, "Who was tried under the Nuremberg laws?" And before Jim could answer, the judge said, "Not the British, not the Americans, not even the Russians. Who was tried under these laws?" And Jim said, "The Germans." And then the judge said, "And why were the Germans judged under the Nuremberg laws?" And Jim said, "Because they lost." And the judge said, "That's right, Mr. Dowling. They were judged because they lost. No one is going to judge the winners." He then sentenced my friend to imprisonment. And I wept. Because what this demonstrated to me clearly was that in my country, might is right. And no one will hold our government accountable for war crimes. And what is so distressing is the majority of Australians have voted our government back into power. And the same thing has happened in America and in Britain. We have marched, we have talked, we have signed petitions, but the war goes on. And I have been left with this terrible sense of impotence, sense of powerlessness, that as I've talked to people here, I know that many of you share. We're fighting battles on many fronts, but losing most of them. And as I've reflected on this, I've come to the conclusion that we have made a fundamental mistake. And the mistake is very basic. Many of us have been trying to change them, when in fact, none of us can change anybody but ourselves. If we try to change somebody else, we end up doing the very thing that we oppose, trying to bomb our enemies into democracy. And as Michael Franti will tell you on Monday night, we can bomb the world into pieces, but we can't bomb the world into peace. The reality is we cannot change anybody else but ourselves. And if we try to do so in the name of justice, we will do a grave injustice to others. Many of you are familiar with the great serenity prayer, which goes something like this: God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the alternative serenity prayer. Has anybody read the alternative serenity prayer? Okay. It goes something like this, and since my realization of the fundamental mistake I have been making came to me, this is a prayer I've been able to relate to increasingly, and you may be able to relate to it too. It goes, God, grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change. And I certainly have a few people in mind when I say that. And you too might have a few people in mind. You see their pictures on television all the time, and they represent some of the people that, as hard as we might, we cannot change. And the prayer begins, God, grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change. Then goes on to say, to have the courage to change the one I can. And you may be thinking about who that might be. Well, the prayer concludes by saying, and give me this wisdom to know that it's me. God, grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, the courage to change the one I can, and the wisdom to know it's me. We cannot change them. If we try to, we will become like them. If we want the world to be different, then we need to be different. As Mahatma Gandhi said, we need to be the change we want to see in the world. There are no quick fixes, no slick solutions. The only way our governments are going to enact policies that reflect our concerns is when a majority of us represent the peace and justice that we advocate. Then it will be there in their interest to advocate those policies. Until then, it won't happen. Next year, we're going to celebrate the anniversary of abolition. Isn't that right? 200 years? And in this country, you will be celebrating the enactment of laws in this country to abolish slavery. And the focus, by and large, will be on Wilberforce, right? Who led that campaign in Parliament. But what we forget is that those policies would never have been passed if there hadn't been a groundswell of support in the public for those policies. That was led by the Wesleys. It was the groundswell of revival and renewal that the Wesleys led that made it possible for Wilberforce to pass those policies. We have to rediscover the focus and recognise that if we want change, then we need to be the change we want to see in the world. Specifically, what is the change I'm advocating? Well, up until now, our leaders have advocated what I call Plan A. And Plan A is treating others as they treat us. And it goes something like this. In 9/11, Osama bin Laden ordered an attack on the Twin Towers, the World Trade Center. And as the world looked on in astonishment, bin Laden cried, and I quote, "Here is America struck by God Almighty in one of its vital organs, so that its greatest buildings are destroyed." In retaliation, George Bush ordered an attack on Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, and also an attack on Saddam Hussein in Iraq, who didn't have anything to do with the attack. And he said, "God told me to strike Al-Qaeda, and I struck them. And then he instructed me to strike Saddam, which I did." It was a response based on the notion of treating other people like they might treat us. It's a policy of an eye for an eye that leads us blind to seeing our way forward in the future to make peace and justice. I think we've had enough of Plan A. It's time for Plan B. And I think Plan B is based on a completely different ethic, not treating others as they treat us, or as they might treat us. But it's based on the ethic of treating others as we would like to be treated. In 1993, the Parliament of World Religions was convened in Chicago with over 8,000 people from all over the world representing all the religions of the world. And they came together to explore an ethic that was common to all religious traditions that could address the issue of violence in our world. And the ethic they came up with was, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." And you can find that statement in every tradition, in every culture, and in every religion. It's time for us to move from Plan A to Plan B. To move from treating others in the same way as they treat us to treating others as we would like to be treated. There is no hope for the world unless we become the people that be over against the powers that be and embody the only ethic that can save us from destroying ourselves. But how do we practice that? One of the problems with that ethic is it's a bit vague and a bit fuzzy. We're not sure what it actually involves. The great thing about Jesus is that he unpacked its implications in detail to give us a clear understanding of the way forward in the Sermon on the Mount, which is summarized in the Beatitudes. The difficulty, however, for most of us who are Christians is that we haven't taken the Sermon on the Mount seriously for centuries. There are three reasons. The first reason is that we seldom even hear any sermons on the Sermon on the Mount. It's something that's simply not talked. When I started talking to people in my community about the Sermon on the Mount as an ethical framework for engaging poverty and violence, they looked at me kind of aghast. In fact, one of the guys in my community, a young guy by the name of Nick, he said, "I don't think I've ever heard a sermon preached in my church on the Sermon on the Mount." And I think that's true for many people. The second reason I think that we have difficulty understanding the relevance of the Sermon on the Mount is that not only is it not often taught, when it is taught, it's taught as a kind of wonderful vision of an ideal in the future, but not an ethical framework for engaging reality here and now. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's where it is taught, it's kind of like the kind of passage in literature that you get a beautiful quote from and you put it on a postcard with pictures of beautiful mountains and running streams. You know, represents the great ideal, but it doesn't help you engage reality. The third reason that for many of us, we find difficulty in understanding the relevance of the Sermon on the Mount is this, that when we have recovered it and people are teaching and learning from the Sermon on the Mount as a guideline for our lives, that we have misunderstood it. Now, the misunderstanding of the Sermon on the Mount is understandable because when Constantine became the emperor and Christians supported his regime, most Christians put the Sermon on the Mount aside because it's actually hard to advocate turning the other cheek when you're trying to support a Roman emperor who maintains his empire through the power of the sword. So for more than 1,000 years, we've had very little to do with the Sermon on the Mount as a guideline for engaging reality. So it's not surprising that when we begin to engage the Sermon on the Mount, that we misunderstand it. Our dear brother Dallas Willard, in his book The Divine Conspiracy, a saintly and wise person, has tried to help us recover the relevance of the Sermon on the Mount. But the way he interprets it, I would suggest, makes it impossible for us to live out. Let me show what I mean. Now, this is where I need to find my pen here. Dallas says that the Sermon on the Mount is something like this. You have, on one side, an old ethic, and on the other side, a new ethic. So the old ethic, for example, is thou shalt, what? Not kill. You're all familiar with that? So that's the old ethic. And what Dallas says is with Jesus, there's a new ethic. And the new ethic is thou shalt not even get angry. Do you understand that? You're familiar with the text where it says, Jesus says, you have heard, thou shalt not kill. But I say to you, even those who are angry and swear and abuse one another, and I've heard a few people do that while I've been here, are in danger of the fires of hell. Isn't that, you understand what I'm saying? Now, let's be realistic. Who in this room never gets angry? Okay, there's a man over here who needs psychotherapy. The reality is, Jesus got angry. And he even called his opponents fools. Isn't that true? The very thing that that people like Willard say is forbidden in the new ethic. The Bible never condemns us for getting angry. It condemns us for getting so angry that we violate the rights of others. The scripture actually says, be angry, but sin not. That's right. Okay. The problem with our dear old brother Dallas is that he's understood the Sermon on the Mount in 2D rather than 3D, in two dimensions rather than three dimensions. But it's easy to make that mistake because we haven't engaged the Sermon on the Mount well for a long time. But let me unpack the secret this understanding the Sermon on the Mount as an ethic for engaging the world today. And it's very, very simple. We need to see it not in 2D, but 3D. In the Sermon on the Mount, there are always three sets of statements side by side, not two. You've got the old norm and the new initiatives. But the second set of statements are not the new ethic. They are statements about cycles of violence that are not resolved by the old ethic. So let's have a look at it again. So the old norm is, thou shalt not kill. But Jesus says you can practice that and still get angry and abuse one another. And so the practice of the old norm does not solve the problem. You're still in danger. You still find yourselves in difficulty because that old norm does not guide you sufficiently to engage the issues you're frustrated about. Do you understand what I'm saying? He says the way to deal with this is not to pretend you're not angry when you really are angry, not to pretend you don't curse and swear when you actually do, even if it's only under your breath. The real solution is in the new initiative, which is go and be reconciled. And you can actually go through the whole Sermon on the Mount and look at the 30 statements of Jesus and discover that in fact, rather than this being an unrealistic ethic, it is a profoundly realistic ethic that gives you a creative way of engaging society. It's not possible for us not to be angry. In fact, if we are not angry, it's unhealthy for us. We need to be angry about the injustice in the world. But Jesus says the challenge is to find a creative way of working with your anger, using your anger. And that the way to do that is to use your anger to motivate you to engage the world around about you and meet people face to face and work out problems face to face. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I would encourage you to go through all the statements on the Sermon on the Mount and actually look at each of those. For those of you that are young adolescents, it might be helpful to realize that in those famous sets of statements that Jesus made about looking at lust, those are not in the third set. In other words, those are not prohibitions. They're in the second set of statements. Now, what difference does that make to our understanding of the way we practice the ethic of Jesus? I'll leave you to do your homework on that. The challenge for us is to rediscover the Sermon on the Mount as an ethical framework for engaging a world of poverty and of violence. Now, I believe the first few verses in the Sermon on the Mount provide a summary. And these verses we know as the Beatitudes. I believe it's time for us to reclaim the Beatitudes, to rediscover the Beatitudes as a summary of the kind of people that God wants us to be in this world. Now, I think we've passed out to different people a piece of paper with the Beatitudes on them. What I'd like us to do now is to together just read out those statements out aloud, not too quickly, and then just sit for a moment quietly with them, and then I want to work through a bit of a process with you. If we are going to be the people that be over against the powers that be, if we're going to be the change that we would like to see in the world, I believe we need to embody the spirit of the Beatitudes that represents the ethic of the Sermon on the Mount. And we need to begin our ethical revolution right here and right now. Let's begin by just reflecting on the Beatitudes. Let's read it out together slowly and thoughtfully, and then just spend a moment of quiet reflecting on them. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God. Blessed are the persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. What are the values that are blessed in each of these Beatitudes? I'd like to suggest there are eight. Humility, empathy, self-restraint, righteousness, mercy, integrity, non-violence, and perseverance. What would it be like if we embodied the values that Jesus blessed in the Beatitudes? I'd suggest we'd identify with the poor in spirit. We'd grieve over injustice in the world. We'd get angry, but not get aggressive. We'd seek to do justice, even to our enemies. We'd extend compassion to all those in need. We'd act with integrity, not just for the publicity. We'd work for peace in the midst of violence. And we'd suffer ourselves rather than inflict suffering. I believe it's time for a new reformation. And as Luther took the 95 Theses and nailed them onto the wall of the cathedral in his hometown, I believe it's time to take the Beatitudes out of the Bible, dust them off, print them out, and post them up publicly. Start with your website. Put them on your blog. Post them up on your church wall, on your city council chambers, on your parliament entrance. What would the world be like if we began to practice the Beatitudes? If we began to embody them, not only in our personal lives, but our political lives? There is no solution to the conflicts that we face today if we treat other people the way they treat us. There is only hope for resolution if we treat them the way that we would like to be treated. And the Beatitudes give us clear instructions as to how to embody that ethic in our ordinary, everyday life. Kurt Vonnegut, the very famous American author, wrote a book called Slaughterhouse-Five, said, "In my country, when people quote the Bible, they actually quote Moses. Because it's great to invoke the ethic of an eye for an eye to rationalize war." He says, "But that's Moses, it's not Jesus." As Christians, we are called to follow Jesus. And Jesus doesn't call us to practice an eye for an eye. He calls us to turn the other cheek, to bless those who curse us, to go and be reconciled, to take the risks, to reach out to those who we see or perceive as our enemies. We need to reclaim the Beatitudes as our personal and political modus operandi. There is nothing else that we can do that will help to save our planet. Let me tell you a couple of examples that I just find so inspiring of people that are doing this. After 9/11, the first mosque in the world that got burnt down was in my hometown. But my daughter, my son-in-law, raced to the site. When they got there, they were thrilled to find a whole lot of other Christians that had assembled there to meet the local imam. The imam came out to greet them, and they expressed their sorrow. And then they did something that I think embodied the spirit of the Beatitudes like nothing else I had heard of in recent times. They said to the imam, "We're really dreadfully sorry that somebody has burned down your mosque. We would like to invite you to use our church as a place of worship until you rebuild." Isn't that stunning? Not very Christian, but wonderfully Christ-like. I work for an agency called Tier Australia. We support aid and development projects around the world. We got a request from this little group in Indonesia. They had been persecuted by their Muslim neighbours. And life had been very difficult for them. After 9/11, the Indonesian government cracked down on fundamentalist Muslims. And a whole lot of the people that had been persecuted them now found themselves in prison. Now, most Christians I know would see that as an answer to prayer and rejoice. But not these people. They responded by saying, "We know what it's like to be persecuted, and we didn't like it." And they extended empathy and compassion to their fundamentalist Muslim neighbours who are now being persecuted. And the funding request they sent into Tier Australia was for the money to help them develop a human rights organisation so that they could fight on behalf of the civil rights of their fundamentalist Muslim neighbours. Not very Christian, but beautifully Christ-like. And as they have advocated for their Muslim neighbours and provided support and resources for their Muslim neighbours, the enmity between them is being overcome. Brothers and sisters, I would like this to be the beginning of a new reformation, a new revolution. I would like us to be the revolution. Not to make the revolution, not to do the revolution, but to be the revolution. To be the people that be over against the powers that be. Not to try change them, but for us to change. For us to say, regardless of how people treat us, we will treat them in the way that we would like to be treated. We are going to begin to take the gospel seriously. We are going to be converted all over again. Reclaim the spirit of Jesus embodied in the Beatitudes, and we are going to seek to embody it in our lives. On the way out, I'm going to give you a card for wecan.be, a new website I'm trying to get up, which I hope will resource and support this new revolution. I would invite you to help us get this website up. We want to have on that website a place to sign up and say, yes, we are going to sign on to the Beatitudes. I'd like to have stories of what people are doing around the world to embody the Beatitudes in their ordinary everyday life. I'd like to have pictures of people that are nailing up the Beatitudes on the doors of their city council or their churches. We would like to put you in contact with campaigns and groups and actions and activities where people are trying to embody the Beatitudes. The revolution doesn't require us to do big things. None of us are big people. We can't do big things. We're only little people. We can do little things. But little things can be significant. All of us as little people need to find ways of embodying the Beatitudes in our lives in the little things that we say and do every day. And when the majority of us are practicing this, it will be in the vested interest of our politicians to enact policies that also embody what the majority of us embody in our own lives. In a minute, we're going to be concluding. And as a conclusion, I'd like us to read a creed based on the Beatitudes that helps us to re-envisage the kind of God we seek to serve and the kind of way that we believe God would want us to live our lives. I said on the way out, you'd get a card. There's probably not enough for everybody, maybe for one in two, about wecan.be. Also at the servant's site, there will be a detailed copy of the presentation I've given today that you can get a hold of. And you can actually talk to some of the people there in servants who are trying to get behind this campaign and embody this campaign in what they do as they live in the slums of Asia. Also on the way out, there'll be people from Chaste who are concerned about sex trafficking, which is particularly close to my heart because my younger daughter, who was adopted, was born in Nepal. And I know the reality is if we hadn't adopted her, the most likely outcome for her life is that she would have ended up in a brothel in Bombay, like thousands and thousands of others of her sisters. Brothers and sisters, it's time to stop complaining about the government. We can't expect the government to be better than we are. It's time for us to change, not to change them, but to change ourselves. Let us resolve today for the revolution to begin with us. Let's just conclude with the creed. Maybe we'll stand before we go. So let's just stand and read this creed as a way of concluding. At 2 o'clock, there'll be, by the way, a book signing of Compassionate Community Work, which is a new textbook that's come out that actually gives you a simple step-by-step process of how you can embody these truths in your own neighbourhood. So over at the book stall at 2 o'clock. We've got enough copies for everybody, and I'd be happy to sign them. But let's finish on this note. We believe in God, who cherishes the poor and offers them the riches of the commonwealth of God, who hears the sobbing of the sorrowful and provides them with undying comfort, who sees those who tread softly and humbly and gives them the earth to look after, who satisfies the hungry, thirsty with the hospitality of choicest table, who honours the merciful and shows them the fullness of the mercy of God, who recognises pure hearts and invites them to look upon the glory of God, who strengthens the peacemakers and names them the free children of God, and who suffers with the persecuted and promises. Amen. And God be with you. Thank you very much.